Ed Rouse told me something that I really, well, two things I really find hard to believe. He was a twin.
Oh, he was? I don't know that.
And he and his brother both played ball. His brother was a catcher. He was right-handed. But Ed Rouse told me that until he signed with Louisville, he had always played ball right-handed.
Hmm.
Because there wasn't a left-handed glove around.
I don't know about his ambidextrous.
And when he, you know, he said he was always a better ball player left-handed. He knew that, but he didn't have a glove. And when he signed to play professional baseball, and then in Louisville bought a glove for the first time to fit his...
That's a story now, isn't it?
Yeah. That someone could be good enough to be signed as a professional playing with the wrong hand. You know?
That's a good story.
Yeah.
I got a...
Okay.
May I...
Sure, you can do anything you want.
I bring this over in front of myself, I guess.
My back's getting tired here.
Oh, you want to move back in the bed, or...?
Yeah, I'll move back here and... try to...
brace myself up a bit.
Yeah.
I still have back weakness from the problem in the beginning. And all.
Sitting in the middle of that bed isn't easy.
No.
You give me problems, I know.
I wonder if I can get that up here where I can talk like this.
I can get anywhere you want it.
I don't want to follow you up now.
Oh, no, you're not fat.
You can still hear my voice, I guess.
Yeah, I can't.
My proper distance.
That's good distance, I think.
That's good. That's fine.
The other thing he told me was that he never had a slump. Ed Rouse, he told me, he said he'd get where we'd be popping the ball up once in a while, and he'd get somebody just to go out in the outfield with him and throw him five or six balls until he started hitting line drives again, and then he'd get back in the groove. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but he told me.
Well, he was so darn arrogant. And when he was down there in his last legs down in Florida, he would come out, he was so miserable. He was so miserable to talk to that hardly anybody wanted him around, but he would still come out.
I got both of them. Watch if they overlap. That's
I was around when that scandal. I was just starting to high school when it was discovered, 1920.
Yeah.
And that shocked the world.
All yeah. Right. Ed Rouse didn't like that either. He swore there was no fix.
No fix.
Yeah. And he point, you know, quote you the numbers as to how it couldn't have been fixed because all those players played so well and so forth. Now you said you thought Willie Mays was the
just about the greatest. Clemente a very close second. Clemente was not a home run hitter. He was a line drive hitter, and he hit a lot to right center, and he had that stance that nobody would teach their child to use. And Willie Mays hit a lot of home runs. And Clemente was more of a power alley hitter.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he did hit home runs, but
yeah.
He didn't hit them as prolifically as Mays, I don't think.
I thought Willie Mays was the most exciting ball player I ever saw. I mean, he lit up a ball field like no one else I've ever seen.
Yeah. He was a presence.
Yeah, yeah. In retrospect, I might argue for DiMaggio of the ball players that I've seen.
I didn't see him often enough. Or Mantle.
Uh-huh. I didn't see Mantle enough, but I saw him enough to think that he wasn't as good as DiMaggio. I mean,
wasn't as good, yeah. Well, he had that handicap, that osteoporosy, softening the bone in the leg.
Yeah. I don't know. I wish I could have seen Ruth in his prime, and I did see Jimmy Fox, but not in his prime. I saw him, you know, when he played in the Second World War.
What legs he had!
Yeah.
He came here at an exhibition game. Of traveling after one of the seasons. And boy, what a solid build he had. There were a number of those fellas at that game. He was one. Too bad how he wound up.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like Gibson. They had to bury Gibson. The Grays.
Oh, yeah.
He got into trouble.
Yeah. What, do you know, did you ever hear what happened to him? I mean, what went wrong in his...
No, I think this guy might have gotten in with the wrong people, and I think he drank a lot, I guess, before he... That was his problem, I think.
Yeah. But, I mean, he went so quickly. I mean, that I've always often wondered about that. You know, what was your impression of black baseball in those days? I mean...
Well, some of them were very good players. Mm-hmm. I admire it. We had a guy who played left field and ran the team for a while, Vic Harris. I know he'd have been in the majors. And, of course, I saw Oscar Charleston.
No, you did.
Yeah, oh yeah, he played first base. He used to catch the ball behind him just for fun. Not in the game, but when he was in practice. Uh-huh. A little round fellow, rather heavy set.
Yeah.
And, well, there was Cool Papa Bell, of course. And Buck Leonard.
Yeah.
Incidentally, he was over at the stadium. He had to be helped up to the microphone.
Yeah, I know.
I had a baseball team myself in the... 30s and early 40s, and I had some ex-minor league players on it, and it was run, a numbers man backed me, and we paid the guy something, not a great deal, but he was always there with the money, and we played around Pittsburgh. We played the Grays one time over at McGee Field in Greenfield, and Greenfield Avenue runs past right field and down, and the field is pretty spacious, and Buck Leonard hit the ball over Greenfield Avenue into somebody's yard against this friend of mine, Jack Flynn, who was pitching. We never let him forget it. So they had players like that and excellent ball players. And they played so many games.
Yeah.
They had this bus, and they would come and play after the holiday games sometimes that the Pirates played. The Pirates would play one in the morning and one in the afternoon, and then the Grays would come in there sometimes and play a twilight game on the holiday, and I would usually stay for it. They'd come in, they all had these slippers on, and looked as though they had played two games before that, probably too. And they'd get off this bus across Bouquet Street there from Horse Field and come in and play, and they wouldn't even take a practice.
Yeah.
They just go out on the field.
Yeah.
And there were not all, but I would say, at least a third of them, I think, could have played.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all spread around. I saw a lot of others whose names I can't recall that really were very efficient, great players.
Mm-hmm. You know, the third interview I ever did was with Satchel Paige. And it was just before he died, but it was at the time when John Holway and these people were claiming that Robert Peterson were claiming that the Negro Leagues were superior to the major leagues and all this and all. And I asked one of the last questions. I asked Satchel Paige two questions that really answers really surprised me. I said to him, you know, Satchel, how good were the black teams? Oh, very good, very, very good. You know, and he said, well, I mean, like, could everybody have played in the majors? Oh, no, he said. He said there were teams like the Crawfords, where maybe all nine starters of that team would have been in the major leagues. But he said, generally speaking, off each team, there were three or four men who could have made the major leagues. And I thought that was a very honest estimate. You know,
that kind was.
Of, yeah.
He didn't get, he wasn't senile.
No.
He knew what he was talking about.
And then I asked him a question. This really surprised me. I said, Satchel, all the ball players you've seen in your lifetime, black and white, if you were picking a team, who would be the first guy you'd choose? You know? We were sitting on his bed, he was taking oxygen. He'd take me into his bedroom and show me this Chinese... sideboard that Wilkinson, the team owner, had given him. It was a very expensive piece of furniture, I guess. And he had to sit down in the bed, and I sat down by him, and I asked him that question. He said, I believe if I was picking a team, I'd take that little fellow from Philadelphia. What's his name? I see, you mean Pete Rose? Yeah. He said, I'd take Pete Rose. And I said, why? He said, because I believe he'd kill you to score a run, and that's the kind of guy I want on my team, you know. So that surprised me. I thought it was going to be Oscar Charleston or, you know.
Yeah, somebody like that.
Yeah.
Well, when he came to Pittsburgh first, Lou Smith was a writer for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Lou used to sit beside me in the press box, his press box here, just because the visiting writer stayed over on my side and other road. And he said, Art, I want you to see this young fellow. He said he even runs to first base on a walk. Mm-hmm. And he did. And that's my first look at Pete Rose.
Yeah.
And he was his own worst enemy. That's beside the point now. But he was great. He's another one that would beat you so many ways, like Mays.
Yeah.
A different... He, that remark is right, I'm sure. Well, look what he did to Fosse.
Yeah.
Cleveland, the catcher, he was blocking the plate
in an All-Star game.
Unfortunately, I think it was the end of Fosse's career.
It was a very bright career too.
Yes.
Well, that's what.
That's very interesting to hear him say that.
Yeah, because it really surprised me. I thought previously he talked about Martin DeHigo. Did you ever see Martin DeHigo?
Yes.
You know, he said...
That's one name I forgot to mention.
He said he was the greatest utility man ever played baseball, because wherever you put him, he was better than the guy had there before.
I saw him play the infield a few times, They call it DeHigo.
Yeah.
There's a composing the guys, but DeHigo, you know...
Yeah, well, Satchel called him DeHigo, but so I don't know, but... I thought it would be somebody like that, or Cristobal Torriente. He talked about him, what a great ball player he was.
I remember him.
Well, he's older. He was like the same time as Oscar Charleston's height of his career.
Well, this was in the 20s when I saw them. I didn't see them in the 30s because I was down with polio.
Uh-huh.
But they always talk about the Grays and the Crawfords of the 30s being so great.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not get to see those.
Judy Johnson was in, I think, then, and... I'm still trying to think of the name of that Philadelphia team. All I can think of is the Atlantic City team, the Bacharach Giants.
But that was it. Bacharach.
Oh, Bacharach Giants? Yeah.
Bacharach Giants.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, they had...
The Bacharach came right out when you hit it.
Mule Settles, I guess, played for them. Did you ever see him?
I can't recall him.
He's a guy, first baseman, had a glove full of chicken feathers.
You know? Oh, no.
So when the ball hit it, the feathers would fly out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's a good one, too, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I saw Smokey Joe.
Oh, yeah.
And Little Williams, the left-hander, played for the Grays. Oscar Owens. They called him, his nickname was Jesus.
Jesus.
Why, I never knew. He took me over and showed me that. Showed me something one night. He said, come here, Art, I want you to see this. And he took me over to the boxes beside the Gray's dugout.
Uh-huh.
And this big numbers man, a great big colored man,
uh-huh.
and he was a numbers guy in Pittsburgh here.
Uh-huh.
And he had a diamond set in his front tooth. And Oscar wanted me to see this. He had a barbershop on the... He was a great utility player. He pitched and did other things.
Yeah.
Of course, a lot of those guys did that.
Yeah.
We had a guy, one was a Pennsylvania Railroad porter by the name of Graham, played right field. And Vic Harris's brother, Mo, was an infielder. Those are the Grays, of course.
Yeah.
And some other names, if you'd mention them, I would...
Oh, yeah. Well, there's so many of those guys who... Yeah, it's really a shame they didn't get to play so we could have seen how good they were, you know.
Right. Well, of course, they played here sometimes, and as I said, when the Pirates, Washington, D.C. and Pittsburgh were their home ports. They played a lot in Washington because they couldn't get the dates here, I guess.
Yeah.
But they would win consistently, that league thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
The number of games they played.
Of course, they had a great record against the white teams, too, you know, the great white teams.
I guess they did.
And Satchel Paige explained that to me, too. He said, you know, these white teams, they play 156 games. Okay. And he said, 156 games, you're going to win some, you're going to lose some, you're going to win more and you lose. And so you can sit back and wait and play for a big inning. He said, we play 3-4 games a day.
Yeah.
You got to win them all, you know. So he said, you got to get out there and you got to get every run you can. So he said, we're playing for that one run from the get-go. As soon as the first pitch, we're playing for one run to get ahead. And he said, and that's the way you win a ball game. He said, now you may not win 150, enough out of 156 to win a championship, but you can leave town winning that ball game playing that way. You know? So maybe that's
very
why the record looks
that's
so
very,
good.
Really very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw him in Cleveland when he was pitching up there.
Mm-hmm.
Boudreaux was managing. He brought him in with the bases full one day. Of course, Patsy was not so young at the time.
No.
And he got on the mound with Satchel, and he pointed to third. Then he pointed to second. And he pointed to first. And he handed him the ball. And it was either that year or the next year that they had a day for him. They give him all this stuff, you know. And when he appeared on the field, he came on in a big flatbed truck, sitting in a great big Morris chair that they had given, lying back like this, you know, in this flatbed. This is Vec stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I loved it when I was over there. He had those nights for the fans.
Yeah.
He gave a guy 100 pounds of ice as a prize one night. He'd do silly things.
Yeah.
One night they had an Elks convention, international. And, oh my God, we hardly got any sleep in the auditorium hotel where I stayed down near the ballpark. We had a ranting around the halls at night for two or three days there.
Yeah.
And they had a parade one night. And the story went that the parade was going to give the ball game some competition. What did he do? He brought them down through the ballpark and right out that gate in left field. Whole parade.
Yeah.
There was a gang there from a place in Montana, and we got to know some of those guys. What was the name of that place? It wasn't Billings, but anyway, this is Elks Convention. Very colorful thing. Yeah. And Vec did these things.
Oh, yeah, well. I'm not crazy about some of the promotions that they do in ballparks, but his were so outrageous you had to like them. You know?
Right, and he had that scoreboard.
Yeah.
Jesus, there's this urn, you know, you could see there's flames, or you knew the flames were never, or they missed or something, come up out of there. And when a home run was hit or something, and then back of the scoreboard, two tremendous horns would come out, that you blew, supposedly, and they would make the dance. Talk about these trucks out on the road. That's the way they were fixed. That's what they sound they made when somebody hit a home run.
Yeah.
That was Vec. He's around there on one leg, you know.
Yeah.
Shame, I guess he lost that in the service.
Yeah. Yeah, during the war. Yeah. He had a colorful career, though.
Didn't let that bother him.
No. A lot of people don't. Go right ahead, you. Now, Bill Guilfoyle always wants me to ask a question. And, of course, you knew Bill. A wonderful man.
Never forget him.
Yeah.
PR man here.
Yeah.
He was extremely nice to me when he came.
I think he's extremely nice to everybody.
I think so, too. One of the nicest men I ever knew in my life.
Me, too.
Gentle.
Yeah.
But accomplishes things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've seen him be mean, believe it or not.
Well, yeah. He had trouble with our scoreboard people in hanging up the half innings one time. Uh-huh. And I couldn't get them to do it. They didn't want to get up off their cans and hang up a half inning. I wanted to wait till the whole inning.
Uh-huh.
And he asked me, he said, please ask him. I said, well, he turned me down. He got on the telephone. He convinced them with his soft way. And talked to him, and from then on, they hung him up in half innings. I just remember that incident.
I was in his office one time, right before a Hall of Fame game, when someone called him. There was a radio station. He had called because they had advertised in a newspaper they were carrying the game.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have the rights to carry the game. And I'm telling you, he read them out like I wouldn't believe Bill Guilfoyle would. Yeah.
He was back down there. He was stone.
Yeah.
You know, and inside that character. Well, people like that are usually smart enough to use that only when it's necessary.
Yep. Well, Bill always wants me to ask the question of everyone. What was the greatest defensive play you saw?
personally, or just a picture? Or
what? No, no, that you saw personally.
Well, I guess I'm a dinosaur. I have seen 3 unassisted triple plays. And I think they couldn't find anybody when Morandini made his here 2 or 3 years ago. A fellow named Robinson, who writes for the Associated Press, I think, was, and also writes for Morgantown. I don't get that connection, but I saw him again at the Clemente thing. They couldn't find anybody who had seen 3 unassisted triple plays. They were more or less, they were all at second base. And they were all with a couple men on, of course, and Glenn Wright, Jimmy Cooney, and Morandini. I can't see how you could get a greater play than that.
Mm-hmm.
And having seen 3 of them, I have to go with that.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I saw in the movies, and I don't think there was any television at the time, was Willie Mays back and catch a Cleveland outfielder.
Wirtz, Vic Wirtz. Yeah.
Vic Wirtz, yeah. That would have been the greatest play I had ever seen, individual play.
Yeah.
There were a couple of factors about these triple plays that were so obvious that it didn't take much moving.
Uh-huh.
You caught the ball, and the guy was already on the move, and all right. He did was step on second base.
And wait for him to come.
And the guy came right into your arms, practically.
Yeah.
But those were the most impressive.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also depends the situation, too. I mean, Mays was such an important catch at such an important time, you
yes.
know. Or Gene Frito's catch, you know, or things like
that. Oh, yeah, that was yeah. another one.
Yeah.
Well, didn't Sandy, guy from Brooklyn, Sandy...
Amoros?
Amoros catch one, too.
Yeah.
Similar, somewhat similar to Gene Frito's.
Yeah.
Gene Frito was here for a while, you know.
Yeah. But I mean, it depends on the time. Like, I saw Ken Griffey Sr. make what I thought was the greatest catch I've ever seen. I saw on television.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just scaled the left field wall in Yankee Stadium and caught a ball that you can't catch, you know. But it didn't mean anything. They were losing 8-3 or something like that, you know. So you don't remember that like you remember something.
You see so much of that these days.
Yeah.
These outfielders are getting up over that fence.
Yeah.
And there's almost one every month.
Yeah.
Someone loses a home run.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Les Chamberlain, who's not a very good outfielder, took one away last
week. Yeah, I saw that one on ESPN. Incidentally, the All-Star game I sat up there right beside the booth of the ESPN people, Peter Gammons and Berman.
Yeah.
It seemed as though, you know, I see them so much on TV, it seemed unbelievable to look through the glass and there they are in the next booth.
Now, you shouldn't be starstruck of all people.
You're but people like that you see on TV, it gives you a little shock sometimes to see them walking around.
Yeah, it does.
No, I've seen I've had much that I've seen a lot of, there are a lot of stories I could tell if I hadn't talked to you for a while longer, but things that I've seen.
Oh, I don't want to tire you out. You go for therapy every day, do you?
No, a couple of days a week. I go down there. I don't do much walking any longer. I wore out my elbows and they're full of arthritis. So I get up now and I do get on the crutches, and then I surrender the crutches and take the back of a wheelchair, the handles. My wheelchair is there in the living room. And someone moves the wheelchair along. I can't use a walker. I don't have enough power in my back. What they call the extenders, which keep you erect. And so that's been the case. But I got around on crutches pretty well when I did get back on my feet in the 40s. And it wouldn't even bother me unless I got tired. I was pretty good and never graceful at all. I had to wear a brace on one leg, which is right over here. Weighs about 8 pounds, and it's something to drag around all your life. But the swimming helped me. They got me in a swimming pool within a year after the polio, where you can move your muscles without weight bearing. Weight bearing is the enemy when you're trying to bring the muscle
back. Yeah.
So I swam a year before I walked. I didn't even know how to swim. I had to learn. I was weak and the water was a little cold. I was scared to death of the water. The whole thing's been kind of a nightmare, but I'm here, so I think about it as a problem.
I can remember when I was a little tiny kid on the Atlantic City boardwalk, going in to see someone in an iron lung. You know, you paid a dime or something to see.
My doctor was a person who either he furthered that, Dr. Jessie Wright, a woman doctor. And she was flown to South America one time with a load of iron lungs. And she used to say to me, well, Arthur, when I feel discouraged, I think, well, I'm glad I'm not an iron lung.
Yeah.
And then she invented the rocking bed, which never caught on. At the Watson home here for little girls, mostly. But I went down there with her one time. She was my guide. She brought me out of this thing. Never a question I asked her that she didn't answer. I remember I went up golf course. I had played a lot of golf. Oakley Park here mostly. I was a duffer, hacker. And I went up to watch them tee off one day there at number one hole. It kind of bothered me. I got into tears and I came home. And I, you know, I was thought I'd get back further than I did. I asked her point blank. I said, Doctor, you think I'm ever going to be able to do that again or play golf on it? Well, she said, we're going to try to get you onto a cane. And she said, don't you know that all the young men are wearing canes these days? A little soft thing like that. And I used to go back to her. I'd say, Dr. Wright, I got to come back here and get you straightened out a couple of things. I got to come back and for somewhat for a refuel on courage. And she never was, I was her first polio patient.
Oh.
And she wanted me to get into the water. She wanted to even get me in a bathtub in our little apartment. But that was not feasible. So I was in bed 9 months without getting off the bed. My mother and grandmother took care of me. My grandmother had been a practical nurse. My mother was in her 50s, had to get up and take care of this lout of 23 years old. I had a whole set of exercises that Dr. Wright gave us, but what I was trying to say, the swimming, I gradually was able to get on my feet with a brace and crutches after I'd swam for a year. And that was 1931. Then from there I progressed with Dr. Wright's advice and encouragement, and everybody's encouragement for that matter, until I never learned to get up and down steps very well. It was too awkward for me. I was somewhat tall, and but I was able to get around on a level pretty good. I've even walked in snow, then I was fortunate. I got a job with the city, took an exam. I had Lee in the resume. And I didn't do too badly then until the arthritis caught up with me. And that's what's wrong now with these elbows. I don't have any problems with moving normally, but lifting myself, it's hard. And so I use a wheelchair most of the time now. I get around, though. A lot of people take me to the games. And even though I retired, I saw about half the games last year. And I'm trying to get there Friday and Sunday usually this year.
And not a lot of fun to watch this year, are they?
Pardon me? No. No. I have to be near baseball somewhere, though.
Oh, yeah.
It's been so large a part of my life.
Yeah.
My father was a great fan. He got me started.
Yeah.
If he could see what I was doing, when I finally wound up doing the announcing and running scoreboards, it was as close as I'd get. I know he'd have been awfully proud.
Oh, sure.
I know he was awfully proud when he saw me on that field as a bad boy. Oh, boy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... those are all great accomplishments that people really be proud of.
Well, I just sort of got in there by osmosis.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to tire you out completely, Mister.
Well, I'm tiring you out.
No.
As though I am anyhow.
I could listen to stories all day long. There's nothing better than baseball stories, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, there's plenty of them, aren't there?
Oh.
You see them. I tell you, the ball players have a special sense of humor.
They do. Well, I think they have so much time on their hands.
Yeah, yeah, they do. And they also, they point out people's frailties and dwell on them.
Yeah.
And, of course, they said Clemente and Dave Justy had something going for them all the time, picking at each other and staying loose. Stay loose, it's a term, you know.
around baseball it is, stay loose. Yeah, I'm gonna end the interview. I wanted to tell you something. I,